One of the questions people keep asking these days is whether more privacy is worth less security. There have been at least three public opinion surveys on the question in the past month, and Americans seem pretty split on the issue. Shane Harris says that cyber sleuthing is real and powerful, particularly when it happens between governments and corporations. Harris wrote The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State. In 2011, Steve asked him just how many Americans' communications are being watched.
I think it's a lot of people. I mean, to draw the lines, I mean, there are certainly more non-Americans who are being watched than Americans. The law does not permit the intelligence community or the FBI or any agency of government to monitor the phone calls, emails, and other content of communications of Americans without a warrant. They have to get permission from a court to do that. But what is going on a much more meta level, if you like, is the government is monitoring traffic patterns of communication. They are monitoring phone records without monitoring the content. They're looking at information coming into and out of the United States on the internet. At the same time, you know, the counter to this is that, you know, the chances are probably pretty good that if you're minding your business, if you're not engaged in trying to plan an act of terrorism, the intelligence community is probably not that interested in your phone calls and your emails because, frankly, they have a lot of them to get through. I think that's sort of thin reassurance for a lot of people, and me included, because you can see how the surveillance state over time keeps growing. It is the government's instinct to keep trying to consume more and more information, and very little attention is paid to how it's used. And I really, one of the reasons why I wrote the book was I wanted people to start thinking about the consequences of this kind of collection, not just, you know, from the, you know, the sort of obvious concerns about freedom of speech and curtailing rights, but do we really want to have a government that's consuming all of this information without knowing how it's being used and if it's even being used effectively?
Now, there is danger of possible attacks on the United States operating on at least a couple of levels. There are the rogue terrorists who try to blow up planes. There are also sophisticated foreign hackers who are trying to get into the Pentagon's computer network, which potentially could be a whole lot more dangerous. So what's happening there?
This is really the next frontier in surveillance. It's the realm of cyberspace. And what we've seen in the past 2 or 3 years is a dramatic increase in the number of attempted penetrations and successful penetrations of government, military, and also corporate networks. Google announced that its corporate network was penetrated by hackers who were able to steal some of its intellectual property, its sort of secret sauce of how it does Google. It was a really extraordinary admission because very few companies ever come forward and talk about this kind of thing. But it's happening all the time. It's happening every day. Secrets are being stolen. Power grids are being probed.
Wasn't there a case back in 2007 when there's a good deal of evidence that the Chinese military actually did hack into Pentagon computers?
Yeah, I mean, we've had evidence that secret networks even in the Central Command, for instance, the U.S., the military Central Command, some foreign unknown entity penetrated those networks as well, which was quite a feat considering they're not actually connected to the public internet, which means that somebody somehow got something inside the room where these computers are contained and managed to load it into the network. So we know this is happening. It's been sort of a we'll look the other way, maybe. We don't want to say out loud officially that we know it's China or that the Russians are doing this, but everyone knows it.
So I have to ask, are there comparable efforts by the U.S. government to hack into, let's say, Chinese and Russian computer networks?
There are. They're being kept, I think, very secret right now because of the obvious implication that I don't think we want to start a cyber arms race. But the government has been pretty public in its establishment of something new at the Defense Department, what they call Cyber Command. And this would be a place that would have responsibility for defense of military networks, but also the place where we would essentially launch a response or an attack, even if we did it preemptively, on another network. And we have had limited instances of cyber attack in warfare. In 2007, the NSA, under the authorization of President Bush and actually at Mike McConnell's urging, launched a very targeted, sophisticated cyber attack on the cell phones that were being used by Iraqi insurgents, particularly the ones who were planting IEDs, roadside bombs, and were really racking up tremendous casualties.
Did that work in Iraq against the insurgents?
You know, people who I've talked to about this says it actually was quite effective. And this kind of intelligence effort, coupled with the better information we were getting from human sources on the ground and from predator drones in the air and surveillance aircraft, people say that this cyber intelligence actually was more useful than the actual troop surge in actually turning the advantage back to the Americans. So people have a lot of faith in this, and they've seen it do really tremendous kind of, you know, wow sort of things. And I think rightly see it as the future of warfare, or certainly a major component of warfare in the future.
But this is also really serious. I mean, if we're talking about actually using this technology as a weapon to create cyber weapons, in fact, you say that any use of cyber weapons requires authorization of the president. Basically, they are treated as if they are nuclear weapons.
That's right. They're treated as strategic weapons the same way we treat the nuclear arsenal. And the reason for that sort of underscores the potency of these cyber weapons. If we release a computer virus, let's say, against an adversary's financial system to try and knock out the banking system and cripple it, what's to say that that virus couldn't quickly replicate itself and spread through the network, through the internet, to which those financial networks are connected, and knock out the banks of an allied country? What's to say it couldn't even blow back on us? I mean, it really underscores the way in which modern communication systems connected to the internet are completely interconnected, and so much of that traffic moves through the United States. If you lay out a map of kind of the internet backbone, if you like, and you look at the United States in the center of that map, it looks like a heart with arteries and valves coming in and out. I mean, most of the physical pipes that move traffic on the internet come into and out of the United States. So when we attack overseas, it may be the other side of the world, but it can, in a millisecond, bounce back on us if we're not careful.
So is this the future of warfare, that the decisive battles will be fought in cyberspace?
I think that's a real possibility. I think the notion that we would somehow destroy the physical world through the exchange of nuclear weapons at this point seems preposterous. I suppose it's still a real threat. But countries are pursuing weapons in cyberspace, and there are no treaties governing their use. There's no real understanding of what the laws of war are. But no one, the United States included, is sitting back and letting the other guy get the upper hand. There is an arms race in cyberspace.
Well, this is all very frightening, I have to say. I mean, the threats out there are real, and yet they're also tremendous risks that we are starting to live in a surveillance state, that there are all these people out there who are monitoring everything that we do. And I guess it raises the question, is anyone watching the watchers?
You know, that's, I think, the real key question. And unfortunately, I find that the answer is not really. There's a trade-off to be had here. On the one hand, we live in a world where people try and carry bombs onto airplanes and where governments try and break into computer systems and probe electrical grids, and that's a threat, and it's real. And on the other hand, we have this system in place that is trying to ward against those attacks. And to do that, they have to consume a lot of information and watch a lot of people. In order to be effective, there has to be a real understanding and a lot of hard and fast rules for how they go about doing that job. And in the United States, over the past 25, 30 years, which is the span of the book, really, we have focused all of our attentions, almost all of our attentions, on the front end. What are the rules for collecting the information? Who can you collect on? Under what circumstances can you collect it? And the law has pretty much settled that issue to the point where now the government, for practical purposes, can watch whoever it wants, whenever it needs to watch. So we haven't really paid any of this attention to who's watching the watchers, both to make sure that they're not going over the line and that they're actually using this information in a smart way. And I think that's where the conversation has to go now. It falls to the Obama administration to do this. It's not going to be a congressional prescription here. This is going to depend on the government setting up rules, hopefully transparent, for how it uses this information, knowing that information is just the currency of war and security and life as we know it now.
That's Shane Harris talking with Steve Paulson back in 2011. Harris wrote The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State. I'm Tim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.